This is Ocean Robbins, and I am so glad to welcome you to day two of the Food Revolution Summit. I want to start off today with an apology. Yesterday, our servers were hit with an attack. We had a massive engagement from our 100,000 participants, and we expected that. But we were not ready for a distributed denial of service attack, which is what came at us. A team of engineers worked all day, and I'm happy to say that we should hopefully have weathered the storm and be stronger on the other side. And I want to thank all of our listeners for hanging in there with us. The food revolution is alive and well, and we will not be stopped by toxic food or by malicious attacks. We realize and apologize that not everyone was able to hear yesterday's terrific presentations by Drs. Mark Hyman, Dean Ornish, and Caldwell Esselstyn. To make these presentations accessible to everyone, we're putting them on replay for the rest of the summit. Now that our systems have been upgraded and expanded, we are ready and eager to welcome you now to day two. Today's topic is, and justice for all, how to fight food tyranny and stand up for a better world. In a few moments, you'll hear us on the line with a brilliant speaker named Saru Jayaraman. At the top of the next hour, you'll hear from Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman. And an hour after that, you'll hear from best-selling author Dr. Raj Patel. After each interview, you'll hear pre-recorded bonus presentations and music until the top of the next hour, which is when the next interview starts. Here we go. Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Saru Jayaraman. Saru Jayaraman is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California at Berkeley. She was recently chosen by CNN as one of 10 visionary women who are helping other women find success, self-esteem, and sometimes a safe haven. Saru is the author of Behind the Kitchen Door, What Every Diner Should Know About the People Who Feed Us. She's showing us that the women who put food on the tables of restaurant goers everywhere are often struggling to put it on their own. And she's working to change that. So now, Saru, my dad and I are so grateful for your incredibly important work, and we're so excited for this time with you. And now, for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and welcome, Saru. We are so grateful for the work you're doing, really, and for the opportunity to bring it to our audience.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
A lot of people today are not happy with industrial food. They're rebelling against the standard American diet. They're buying organic. They're demanding that GMOs be labeled. They're deploring the treatment of animals in factory farms. They're calling for fundamental changes in how we grow and process and think about our food. But it seems that the hardships and the working conditions of restaurant workers have not been given nearly as much attention. You point out that restaurant servers are three times as likely to live in poverty compared to the rest of the U.S. workforce. And I want to ask you, why have you made it your mission to expose this truth? And why is it critically important for all of us to become aware of it?
Yeah. So personally, I kind of fell into focusing on the restaurant industry because of the 9/11 tragedy. I had been organizing immigrant workers. I'm a lawyer by training, organizing and fighting for the rights of low-wage immigrant workers because my parents are immigrants, and I felt compelled to do that work. When 9/11 happened, there was a restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, Tower 1, and on that morning, 73 workers died in the restaurant, and about 250 workers lost their jobs just from that one restaurant, and about 13,000 restaurant workers lost their jobs in the months and weeks that followed. And so I was asked to start a little relief center for these workers post 9/11, for the survivors and the families of the victims. And what started as a little relief center post 9/11 has grown dramatically, rapidly into a national restaurant workers organization. We now have 13,000 restaurant worker members in 32 cities across the country. We have over 100 high road employer partners, restaurant owners who are doing the right thing, providing livable wages and working conditions to their employees and several thousand consumer members. And the reason why we've grown so rapidly is the same reason why your listeners, the food movement, really everybody in America should care about what's happening in this industry, because this industry right now is the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. It's the reason we've grown so fast, just responding to demand from these workers. It is the largest and fastest growing sector of the food system. It's over half of all food system workers are restaurant workers. It's over 10 million workers nationwide. One in 12 Americans right now works in the restaurant industry. Unfortunately, it happens to be the absolute lowest paying employer in the U.S. So why should we care? We should care because when you have the largest and fastest growing industry in America proliferating the absolute lowest paying jobs, this industry is basically setting the floor and growing the poverty wage jobs of America, because these are the jobs that are available and they're the absolute lowest paying. So that's one reason to care a lot, because this industry is changing our economy and really pulling it down to the lowest wage possible. The second reason we should care is that almost every American eats out, and we eat out more frequently than anybody else on earth. And the fact that the workers who touch, prepare, serve our food are the poorest paid workers in America, don't have benefits like paid sick days, impacts our health, impacts our dining experience, should impact our thinking if we consider ourselves to be in any way, shape, or form conscientious consumers.
When workers are paid so little, when they receive no paid sick days and no health benefits, I would think they would have a very strong incentive to work even when they're sick. That would in turn pose a health risk, or could, to diners. Are there ways that the substandard working conditions that you described, such as low wages and discriminatory and exploitive labor practices and unsanitary kitchens, affect the meals that arrive at our restaurant tables?
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's one thing that most Americans don't know, and that's that the reason why the industry is the largest and fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy is because of the power of the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, which has been named the 10th most powerful lobbying group in Congress, which, by the way, are the same folks who got ketchup and pizza declared vegetables in Congress, which have fought so many public health restrictions or regulations or laws that the food movement cares a lot about, from soda taxes to junk food marketing to low-income and youth communities. You know, these are the same folks. These are the same folks. They're responsible for Fast Food Nation. They are the Burger Kings and the McDonald's and the Olive Gardens and Red Lobsters of the world. And back in 1996, they were led by a man named Herman Cain, who later tried to run for president. And under Herman Cain's leadership, they struck a deal with Congress saying that they wouldn't oppose an increase in the overall minimum wage as long as the minimum wage for tipped workers stayed frozen forever. And so it's been stuck at $2.13 an hour for the last 23 years, which means that the vast majority of servers who serve you when you eat out actually get a wage that's so low, between $2.13 an hour and $5 in most states, so low that it goes entirely to taxes, and they're living completely off of their tip. Now, if all you cared about was your health, then you're right. You should care about that, because if you live completely off your tips and you don't have paid sick days, you are going to go to work no matter what, because your income doesn't actually come from a wage. It comes from the tips that you can only get if you're at work physically serving somebody. And that means that you're going to work with everything from H1N1, which is a true story in my book, a worker who worked with H1N1, better known as swine flu. We've had members testify in legislatures that they've worked for weeks with typhoid fever. There are prominent cases of workers working with hepatitis. You know, the CDC has reported that of all norovirus outbreaks, which is the stomach flu, 50 to 90% of them can be traced back to sick restaurant workers. So when you earn a wage as low as $2, when you live completely off your tips, when you have no paid sick days, you are definitely going to work when sick, and you can count on, as a customer, the fact that 90% of the time when you eat out, the worker is being forced to work regardless of whether they're sick or not, and most likely you're frequently going to be served by somebody who is sick. one of the worst examples is the fact that in 2011, the Olive Garden announced a partnership with Michelle Obama and her Let's Move campaign, saying that they were going to provide healthy food for kids at the Olive Garden. At the exact same moment that that announcement was made, a server in Fayetteville, North Carolina, was forced to work with hepatitis A, worked on tips, earned the tip minimum wage of $2.13 an hour, had to go to work to get those tips, but also had no paid sick days, so essentially had to go to work because she knew she wouldn't be paid if she didn't, and was forced to work with hepatitis A. 3,000 people had to get tested for having eaten at that Olive Garden by the County Health Department, filed a consumer class action against the restaurant, and won. So we have to ask the Olive Garden, how healthy can your food really be for kids if they're exposed to hepatitis A, norovirus, when they eat out? So those are the reasons why you should care if all you're thinking about is your own health. But I do want to say one other thing that I hope most people of good conscience will care about, which is when you have a wage as low as $2.13 an hour or even $5 an hour and your wages are so low they go entirely to taxes and you're living off your tips. Now, 70% of the workers who live off their tips are women. And that means that these women are forced to essentially please every new customer that comes in the door, put up with whatever the customer might do, however they might touch them or treat them or talk to them, because their income comes from the customer, not from their employer, which means the restaurant industry is the single largest source of sexual harassment claims in the United States. 7% of American women work in restaurants, but 37% of all sexual harassment claims come from the restaurant industry. We are exposing millions of women in America to not just the lowest wage, poverty wage jobs out there, to abject poverty and the inability to serve their families, but also we are exposing them to the most demeaning treatment, the worst vulnerability to sexual harassment, because we are forcing them to sell themselves to get their income from customers as opposed to from their employer.
As a diner, if you leave a restaurant after eating without paying the bill, management will come after you. They can call the police. You're legally required to pay your bill, but you're not legally required to tip. If you leave without tipping, the workers have no recourse. We live with this situation. It seems normal to most of us because it's been the case for a while. But something about it seems deeply wrong to me.
Absolutely. It is deeply wrong. And I think to me the thing that's most deeply wrong is that sometimes when we don't give a tip, I don't blame the American public. Most of the American public doesn't actually know that these workers' wages come from their tips. Most of the American public, when they tip, they think the tip is on top of the wage rather than the wage itself. Which, by the way, is the way it should be. The tip should be on top of the wage, not the wage itself. But because of this system where this industry has gotten away, being the only industry in the world that says we shouldn't have to pay our own workers' wages, you, customers, you should pay our workers' wages for us. Because of that, when we eat out, we do not realize that the tip we're leaving is not actually a tip. It is a wage. And so we do encourage people, please tip these folks well, they rely on your tips to live, but we do also say, please don't leave this conversation thinking the best we can do is just tip better, because if we continue to just tip better, we're going to continue to subsidize an industry that continues to get away with basically saying our tips are the workers' wages and that should be good enough. It is not good enough.
When you mentioned that the federal minimum wage for tipped workers remains today at only $2.13 an hour, I found myself shivering. And it's been stuck there for nearly a quarter century, and you attribute that in large part, and I know this is true, to the efforts of the National Restaurant Association. But the NRA, the National Restaurant Association in this case, constantly claims that its members cannot possibly afford to pay higher wages. They threaten that if wages were to increase, it would mean much higher prices for fast food and other restaurant fare. This is a politically potent argument because it scares off support for raising the minimum wage, and that is why they make it. Saru, is there any truth to the NRA's claims that prices to the consumer would go through the roof if fast food restaurant workers were paid a living wage?
So it's a great question, and I'm an academic at UC Berkeley. I got together with academics from UC Davis, And taking their argument, precisely that argument, we used USDA methodology and we applied the current minimum wage bill moving through the Senate that would raise the overall minimum wage to $10.10 and the tip minimum wage to 70% of that. We applied that to every single worker along the food chain, from farm workers to meat and poultry processing workers to restaurant workers. And we assumed that every employer along the food chain would pass on 100% of the wage increase to the next purchaser along the chain. And at the end of the chain, that restaurants and grocery stores would pass on 100% of the wage increase to customers, which, by the way, is an outlandish assumption because in the history of minimum wage increases, typically employers do not pass on the wage increase to customers. They absorb it. But in this case, we assumed, okay, let's say they passed on 100% of the wage increase to customers. Well, the title of the report is A Dime a Day, because at most, it would cost the average American household 10 cents more for all food bought outside of the home. That's restaurants and grocery store food alike. So that's pennies on the dollar for your hamburger in a restaurant and pennies on the dollar for your groceries. And I not only think Americans can afford that and would want to pay that, but I also think that that is actually not what it would be. It's not even going to be 10 cents because employers tend not to pass on the cost of minimum wage. Then we actually applied a $15 wage for all workers, tipped and non-tipped, and we found that at most it would be a 40 cents increase in the cost of food. So we're talking very, very minimal cost increases for 30 million workers in America to come out of poverty. Now, the best evidence that we have that this is true is the fact that the states with the highest minimum wages in the country for restaurant workers, that's California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Alaska, and Montana, these states have no difference between tipped and non-tipped workers' wages, and the cost of food is not higher in these states than it is in the rest of the country. And five of those seven states have faster restaurant industry growth rates than the industry nationally. In fact, we found they have higher restaurant sales per capita than the restaurant industry nationally. So you can do better as an industry if your workers fare better. We know that to be true. I think the answer to your question is no. There is no truth to any of this, any of these arguments that the NRA makes. It is purely political. It is a way to scare off the opposition. And the data just points in the opposite direction.
It seems to me that you're expanding our definition of what sustainable food means. Most of us think it means food grown without pesticides. We think of livestock that are raised humanely without hormones or antibiotics. We think of locally sourced foods that are healthy for our bodies and the earth. But if we're going to eat mindfully, we can't be selectively conscious. And the questions you're raising are crucial. How sustainable is it to eat food that is served to us by workers who can't afford to feed their families? How sustainable is food that is brought to us by workers who have their wages and their tips stolen by their employers? I know you've been involved in many cases in which wage theft and tip theft has occurred. Can you tell us about those?
Absolutely. We've actually won at this point over $9 million in stolen tips and wages for thousands of workers in large companies across America. Unfortunately, this kind of abuse and exploitation isn't reserved to the, you know, McDonald's of the world or the restaurants that the food movement often stays away from. Unfortunately, some of our very best friends and allies in terms of restaurant owners who really embrace locally grown, organic, sustainable concepts themselves are not great in terms of their employment practices, whether it's misappropriation of tips and wages or racial and gender segregation or discrimination or just poverty wages and lack of benefits. I think we need to encourage and push some of our friends who embrace issues of sustainable and local when it comes to organic and local sourcing, push them to also have sustainable working conditions, because you're absolutely right. How sustainable or how good is it for you as a conscientious consumer to be eating a wonderful organic biodynamic meal and wine if the person cooking the food is sick on it, if the person bringing you the food is earning $2.13 an hour, is being sexually harassed by the next table or by their manager, or if their wages or tips are being stolen. It's just, if you don't want to eat misery in terms of you want to make sure that the animals and the environment are treated well, well, you're still eating misery because the hands that are bringing you that food are extremely miserable. And so it's just impossible to separate the issues. And here's another reason why we need to embrace each other and each other's issues. The truth is that we have the same enemy. When you talk about the industrial food system, really the source of so much of the food system's problems is corporate consolidation in a food system. Some people call it big food. Well, there's corporate consolidation at every level of the food system, right? Whether it's industrial ag or industrial meat and poultry processing, or it's the National Restaurant Association. These folks work together. They have common interests. Their common interests are large corporate interests. And we have common interests as people who care about a sustainable food system, and I include sustainable working conditions as part of the definition of a sustainable food system. So expanding our definition of sustainability helps us not only eat more ethically, eat more conscientiously, think about what we're eating, push our friends in the food movement to do better by their workers, but it also helps us come together to understand we have a common target in changing this very large corporate-controlled industrial food system, both on the restaurant level and on the agricultural and production level.
I've seen our economy change in recent years. We all have. In restaurants, it used to be that you would walk in and you'd just see kids who were working the McJobs. You saw a fast food worker, and he might have been a 17-year-old. Now, you walk into a fast food outlet, and you find adults holding these same jobs. In the past, we gave special exemptions to fast food companies because they were employing teenagers and students and part-time workers. Now they're employing adults, some of whom are trying to raise children on the money they earn. And when these workers are paid so little that they need food stamps disproportionately and Medicaid, the real costs of these low wages are borne by the taxpayer, not by the corporation that is making billions of dollars. Restaurant workers in this country are at the bottom of the food chain, really. What can we do about this, Saru?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I would just make one slight tweak to what you said. I totally agree with you that these are adults. In fact, the median wage of restaurant workers is in the late 30s. Over a quarter are parents. They're working adults, and many, almost 50%, are college-educated. But they actually always have been adults. I mean, I know there's this perception that in the past they were teenagers, and certainly there are teenagers working in this industry, but adults have always been the majority of this industry, and I'll tell you why. I mean, there are millions of Americans who take great pride in food service. Maybe they start in McDonald's, but they have aspirations of becoming a fine dining server or bartender, maybe one day owning their own restaurants. There are millions of workers in our industry who aren't trying to do this as something passing to move on to something else. They take great pride, and they want to be treated as the professionals that they are. So to really support them, to all of us to say, yes, these are professionals. We want to be served by professionals. They want to be treated as professionals. Let's professionalize this industry. We're asking consumers to help us get there in three ways, by doing three things. The first is to read my book, get educated, in the same way that Omnivore's Dilemma and Fast Food Nation really put local sourcing and organic and sustainable food system ideas on the map, really made them household names. We need you all to read this book and understand deeply the dramatic crisis we're in with regard to workers in our food system, that really the food system is not a bad employer. They are the absolute worst employer in the United States collectively, and the restaurant industry in particular within it. So that's number one, is to read that book and get educated, please. Number two is to join us. We've created a website called thewelcometable.net where consumers can learn more, read more, but they can also sign a petition calling on Congress to do the right thing, stop listening to the National Restaurant Association, and change the system so that these workers get a livable wage, get a wage so that they're not relying on our tips. And the third thing we're asking of everybody who eats out is, as I said, please don't think the best you can do is just tip better. Please do tip better, but more importantly, number three is to please speak up every time you eat out, or at least as often as you can. When you go eat out, rather than talking to the server, go up to the manager or owner at the end of your meal and say, I love the food. I love the service. I would love to see you provide a livable wage to all of the workers in your restaurant rather than making them live off their tips. I would love to see you provide paid sick days because I want my family to have a healthy experience, you know, be healthy when they're eating out. And I would love to see you promote the people of color and immigrants in your restaurant to front of the house, server and bartender positions. I value diversity in who serves me. We think you speaking up in this way could have a big impact. We've seen it work with regard to consumers saying, you know, is this local? Is this organic? Is this vegetarian? Does this have pork? What's in my food? We've seen restaurants change dramatically over the last decade based on that kind of consumer questioning. We would like to see the same kind of change occur for these workers by everybody who's eating out actually speaking up when they do eat out.
Those are wonderful steps, and I want to tell our listeners that the name of your book is Behind the Kitchen Door, and I've read it, I love it, and I learned a lot from it. And when you were talking just now, the third step that you mentioned, and you mentioned diversity issues, it seems to me that in most of the restaurants I've eaten in, the workers in the front who serve customers are lighter skinned, while those in the back, hidden in the kitchen, are darker skinned. Is that just my experience, or is that representative of the industry as a whole?
Well, it's fabulous that you noticed that, because unfortunately it's so normalized, it's so pervasive, that most people don't even notice it until you talk about it. You say, have you noticed that when you eat out, and particularly in nicer restaurants, your server is generally white, your busser may be Latino. In New York, often bussers and runners are Arab, Bangladeshi. And the further back into the restaurant you go, the darker skin it gets. In fact, it's so true that there's a $4 wage gap between white workers and workers of color in America. In the restaurant industry, workers of color are relegated to lower level segments, meaning fast food and casual restaurants as opposed to fine dining, but also lower level positions like kitchen staff, bussers, runners, as opposed to servers and bartenders. So, again, this is something that we think can change through consumer demand. Consumers saying, I would love to see more people of color servers. I would love to interact with people of many different backgrounds when I eat out. We do think that that will make the industry realize this needs to change. It's quite archaic. I mean, when you think even of the terminology, the fact that you've got white workers in the what they call the front of the house and workers of color in what they call the back of the house, which is essentially the kitchen, it really reminds one of 1950s in the South. I think most of us think we've come a long way since then. Unfortunately, that's not true in our industry, and we need to change that.
It's an interesting industry. Last Christmas, McDonald's got a lot of bad press when it offered its employees advice, suggesting ways to get out of holiday debt by returning unopened gifts and bringing a sack lunch to work. And that criticism came only weeks after the company had been subjected to a lot of public mockery for providing employees with a budget guide that included no money for heat and $20 a month for health care for a family. More recently, McDonald's posted an article on an employee website helpfully suggesting that workers shop at thrift stores instead of the mall, eat stale bread, and quit complaining as a way to reduce stress. So how has this industry become so disconnected and so utterly tone deaf?
You know, I mean, it's hilarious when you say these things. I mean, it's just absurd. Unfortunately, it's not just McDonald's. It is really all of these Fortune 500 restaurant companies that are part of the National Restaurant Association, from Darden, which owns Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse, and about eight other brands. They're the world's largest full-service restaurant company, to Yum Brands, which is Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, KFC. This is how they all think. And they're very large corporations, you know, where the CEOs make millions of dollars every year. And pay their workers as little as $2.13 an hour. And I think they are disconnected because they haven't been held accountable. They haven't been held accountable, certainly not by legislators, and unfortunately not by us either. They are kind of running rampant. They feel that they're above the law. They certainly believe they're able to pay to keep wages as low as possible because they spend so much in lobbying dollars. Nobody's really holding them accountable. And so that's what we need the food movement to join us in doing. We need the food movement to say with us, enough is enough, this kind of extreme greed, extreme lack of ethics. What you're describing that McDonald's put on a website is absurd and hilarious and is really just a reflection of how most of the corporate executives of these Fortune 500 restaurant chains think, because nobody's telling them otherwise. Nobody's saying, we as a mass of consumers are going to stop eating at your restaurants, or we're going to demand this change, or we're going to tell legislators that we won't vote for them if they side with you. And that's what we need to do. We need for them to hear it from us. I'll give you one quick example. Many of these companies, these same restaurant chains, formed a group called the 29ers. After healthcare reform was passed, they all announced that they were reducing their workers' hours to less than 30 or 29 so that none of their workers would be eligible for healthcare reform, for any kind of healthcare benefits. In Darden's case, which is Olive Garden Red Lobster, so many consumers expressed outrage that the company actually made a public announcement that they were clarifying their stance and they weren't reducing their workers' hours. That's a small example of how people can say, this is absurd, this is ridiculous, enough is enough, we're not going to put up with this severe inequality and greed anymore. It impacts us as diners as much as it impacts the workers. There is a different way of doing business, and hold up, lift up the folks that are doing it right. Yeah, and let legislators especially know that we won't tolerate this kind of cronyism between the legislators and the NRA.
There are some restaurant owners who manage to provide workers a decent standard of living. If someone wants to find restaurants where that's the case, is there a way they can do that?
Absolutely. So we put out a National Diner's Guide that is actually a smartphone app called the ROC National Diner's Guide. In the app and on the guide on our website, it lists about 75 restaurant companies that won awards from us for livable wages, benefits, promotions practices. These restaurants range from some really high-profile chefs like Tom Colicchio, Star Top Chef, is actually a great employer, all the way down to small mom-and-pop restaurants around the country that are doing the right thing. I want to be clear, that list doesn't necessarily coincide restaurant for restaurant with, you know, what people think of in the food movement as the restaurants leading the way on local sourcing, organic and sustainable. And that's where we need to really push to make sure those lists coincide, so that if anybody really is embracing sustainability, they're also embracing the employee side of things. So you can find the award-winning restaurants on our guide, but I do have to say 70 restaurant companies across the country is not enough for us to eat out in exclusively all the time. We should support those restaurants, but we really at the same time need to be pushing every restaurant every time we eat out to do the right thing. So what we say is, don't use the guide to decide where to eat, where not to eat. Certainly use the guide to try to support the high road restaurants as much as possible. But really, wherever you eat out, whenever you eat out, use the app to go up to the manager or owner at the end of the meal and say, I care about the criteria in this app. I want to see you do better. I want to see you get an award in this app, and encourage them to do so. And I think it's not about one person saying it, but if many of us say it, if they hear it multiple times, it will have an impact.
Yes, and I think some of us are reluctant to say something because we think our voice doesn't matter. There are forces at work in our society that make us think our voices don't matter, that make us feel apathetic and resigned and alienated from our power. You are somebody, Saru, who is awakening every one of us to our power to make a difference. Over the past 12 years, your organization, ROC, has led many, many successful campaigns against the exploitation of restaurant workers. You've won back more than $6 million in tips and wages that had been stolen from them. You've helped to bring about policy changes that have improved the lives of many thousands of people, people whose work too often goes unnoticed and unrewarded in the restaurant industry. It's really been a privilege to speak with you today and to bring your vitally important message to our listeners. On behalf of myself, of Ocean, and of everyone involved at the Food Revolution Network, I want to thank you, Saru.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Saru Jeyaraman, co-founder of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United and author of Behind the Kitchen Door. Saru, your message is disturbing and agitating in the best possible way. It's a service to restaurant workers and their families, obviously, but I think it's also a service to every one of us who eats and everyone who wants a more fair and decent society. We thank you so much for your time, for your important work, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Great. Thank you.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. And now we have some pre-recorded bonus messages from some of the people whose lives have been touched by the food revolution. One of the 72,000 participants in the 2013 Food Revolution Summit was Gina Bonanno-Lemos, age 43, from Yorba Linda, California. This is Gina's story in her own words.
My name is Gina Bonanno-Lemos, and this is my food revolution story. I'm a 43-year-old mother of two, and I have never been in better health or had more energy in my entire life. I'll admit this wasn't always the case. Since childhood, I've struggled with colds and flus, debilitating allergies, asthma, strep throat, you name it. I mean, it kept me from going to school and from being with my friends. And my health issues continued and then worsened in my 20s after I had my first child. And I began having sinus infections anywhere from 4 to 6 times a year. And they would last for weeks and weeks before I'd give in and I'd get antibiotics and steroids. Then I started suffering with dangerously low blood pressure, and I developed adult onset cystic acne, which is so gross. And so finally, in my mid to late 20s, I decided I'd had enough. I just was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I went on this mission to change my health, and I began studying everything I could get my hands on regarding nutrition and fitness. And although I was very physically fit, I would lift weights 5 to 6 days a week, and I ate what most Americans consider to be extremely healthy, all low-fat foods, lots of chicken and turkey and fish, but my health problems just persisted on into my 30s, and then finally, after more than 40 years of suffering, something incredible happened. I went to have coffee with a friend, and she introduced me to the idea of a plant-based diet. And I'll admit, although it made perfect sense, the science was there, and I made some small changes, it wasn't until I listened to the Food Revolution Summit in 2013 that it just clicked for me. And I made the full changes, and my health changed dramatically and within a very short period of time. So everyone asked me what it was that had the biggest impact, and I have to say it was the phenomenal knowledge that I gathered from the Food Revolution Summit speakers. it just really was the impetus for such a major change in my life and diet. They opened my eyes to so many things that I was completely unaware of. I couldn't believe I hadn't heard this stuff before. And in particular, the fact that I was eating what mainstream media had brainwashed me into thinking was quote-unquote healthy. And this was based on a very corrupt industry and healthcare system. So now I am ecstatic to report that not only have all of my health issues all but vanished, but I haven't even had so much as the sniffles in more than 15 months. And this is while everyone around me is dropping like flies from the recent flu outbreak. I also no longer need coffee in the afternoon to get me past that, you know, 2 to 3 p.m. fatigue, and I have more energy than I need. And in July of last year, just a few months after making these changes, I had a follow-up visit with a hormone specialist that I started seeing at the beginning of the year. And without any medications, any hormones, she informed me that based on my blood results, that my health markers had all improved, and she said, and I quote, that I had reversed the aging process by changing my diet, and I was no longer perimenopausal. So how cool is that? I have to tell you, this experience had such a profound impact on me, so much in fact that I actually made the decision that after 20 years in my career, I decided to change careers, and I'm now studying to be a health coach so I can help others enjoy long, healthy lives, free of disease, illness, drugs, all that yuck. So I am so incredibly grateful for the Food Revolution Summit and for the empowerment package I got last year, which is awesome. This message is life-changing. I'm absolute proof of that. And for anyone who's listening right now, I just want to tell you, you can change your life. You can change your world. This stuff is real. It absolutely works. And I will be forever grateful and inspired to help spread this message of hope and healing to anyone who's willing to listen. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
And now here's another pre-recorded testimonial. This is from Dr. Pat Spentley, a family practice doctor from Newburgh, Oregon, whose participation in the summit last year helped inspire him to make changes that have led him to lose 50 pounds and transform his medical practice.
Hi, my name is Pat Spentley. I'm a family practice doctor. I'm 51 years old, and I practice in a small community office called Villa Medical in Newburgh, Oregon. As I learned through the Food Revolution interviews that John Robbins performed, I realized that the nutritional training that I got in medical school was just completely inadequate to function as an effective preventative physician. And the information that I learned at the Food Revolution not only changed my own personal lifestyle, but has helped me be much more effective as a physician. Brenda and I have been following a plant-based nutrition program now for a little over a year. I initially made the effort to change because of health reasons. I was suffering from asthma and using a very expensive injection that was given in my arms every 2 weeks, and still suffering from asthma bad enough to need to use prednisone several times over a year's period of time. I enabled myself to eat more plants, and in doing so, realized that the animal-based foods were just not to my liking. My health improved, my energy level is much better, I've lost over 50 pounds, and I feel that I'm going to live a longer, healthier life. As a physician, prior to learning the material that John Robbins introduced me to, I was only able to provide patients with advice about medications, perhaps a referral to see a dietitian. Now I'm able to talk to them with enthusiasm about osteoporosis, about preventing cancer, about how to stay away from being diabetic, hypertensive, obese, to deal with their cholesterol in an effective way with far less reliance on the drugs and the procedures. I feel that I am much more healthy. I've lost over 50 pounds. My energy level couldn't be better. I'm now able to swim 20,000 yards every week. I look and feel better, and I think I'm going to live a far healthier life.
To express your take on what you've been hearing and to find out what other people are saying, post and engage in the comments section at the top of our broadcast page. You'll have to remember to refresh the page so you can see the most recent comments. Our next presentation will be a teleconference interview with Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman. It will start at the top of the hour, followed by Dr. Raj Patel at the top of the next hour. Until then, This is some music from our friend, Bruce Bekvar.